Then looking at page 17, there are three observations that Solomon makes in this particular chapter concerning how things are in the world. The first one is that there is oppression. Whenever there is an inequity of power or standing, where someone has more money, someone has more influence, someone has more might or military strength, whatever the case may be, there is always the potential for oppression, and men being as they are, that happens quite often. And so his conclusion in this, looking at verse 3, it says, when you talk about individuals who are in the present, individuals in the past, he said, better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. So there is that indication that sometimes oppression can be such that it would, again, remember, we're talking about life that is lived without respect to God, that it would be better if someone never even existed than live and suffer as people suffer on the earth. We talked about this last week, that Wilson Adams, the author of this class book, refers to the cynicism of Solomon quite often. And he actually does that again in the discussion questions at the end of this chapter, referring to these verses. He's very cynical in his response. And I kind of take issue with that a little bit. Cynicism, perhaps, but it seems to me that it goes beyond cynicism to despair. He seems to be so beaten down about this, that about the way life is. And so cynicism can, at the very least, turn to despair quickly. being cynical means that you look at things and you always think the worst. With regard to life or a circumstance that you come across. Despair is more an emotional response, maybe the result of cynicism. And it just seems to me that the tone is very despairing in this particular text. So then the second thing, he talks about the rivalry that exists. And this specifically has reference to people who work. And they work hard and they're trying to better their opponent, or better the other individual. And as a result of that, being a workaholic, in effect, is also something that is foolish and vain. He said, verse 6, better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. Trying to get something that really there's no real legitimate benefit to obtaining more. There is that idea that people have that things are going to be better if I have more. But when you get it, you find that really that's not what life is about. And so that's vanity as well. And then the personal delusionment in verses 7 and 8, when he talks about an individual who works hard and tries to make money and tries to get ahead of life, never asking the question, why am I doing this? And he specifically is referring to an individual who is alone and has no one to give it to. Now, there is a separate statement earlier that we discussed, I think it's in chapter 3, where you have an individual who is working hard to give to the one who comes after him, and he doesn't know whether he's going to be a fool or not. But here's an individual who's just working to work just to get ahead. Realization is, once you get ahead, wasted your life getting ahead, and then you die, and there's no one to even leave it to. That's kind of a sad thing. He never asked why, and that we talked a little bit about the vanity of that as well. So those are the three points that were made to start this off. And so he kind of shifts gears a little bit, beginning in verse 9 and going through verse 12, talking about friendship and the value of friendship. Would someone like to read verses 9 through 12 for me there in Ecclesiastes 4? Laura, thank you.
Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken.
Now, you may notice on page 18 that little box over to the right there, point 2. Indicates that Solomon's not discussing marriage. The reason he brings that up is because there are an awful lot of weddings to where these words have been read to indicate the marriage relationship. Two are better than one. And there is truth to that. It's certainly a principle with regard to friendship that can be applied in the marriage relationship. But the point here is that the application is much broader. And so it's talking about kinship or friendship that we might have with any individual. And so I would like to just make note of the benefits of brotherhood, the friends that we have, those that we care for in the church, and the brotherly love that is present in the way that we can help each other. Kind of keep that in mind as we look at these points here under point 2, or Roman numeral 2. So the first thing is the statement of fact, and that is that two are better than one. And he points out here something to do with a direction that we would take in life. So we seek to make a decision as to how we're going to act or conduct ourselves or a situation that will be right and proper in any particular circumstance. And he talks about the benefit of having someone there to counsel you. The two heads are better than one, in other words. And there is truth to that, but only in so much as the one that you are speaking with or deriving counsel from is an individual, number one, who has some wisdom, that's important, but also who has your best interest at heart. And one of the things that happens too often, we'll take as an example with young people, is that they ask wisdom, they ask the help of those of their own age who often themselves are foolish in that they don't have the right proper motives, they don't have the right upbringing, they don't have the right knowledge, and as a result they get bad advice instead of good advice. Now, you would think as people get older that that would become less and less a problem, but it's not, it isn't necessarily. I was, Josh was over at the house a couple of days ago for lunch for about an hour, and didn't have kids that day. It was Monday, I guess. And as he was leaving, he drove off and sent me a text immediately, and he said that next door, that my neighbors and apparently some friends were out in the front yard smoking marijuana, and he couldn't say it for sure because he wasn't close enough, but the way they were holding the little cigarettes and all that kind of stuff indicated that probably wasn't well.
I just stick my head out the door. That's all
saying. And it makes you think that maybe. As you grow older, that some of the foolish things that you do when you're young will go away, but for some people it doesn't happen. And this family is a family that you can see by the way they treat their kids and the way they act and such, that not a lot of wisdom in that group. And so they have friends that are just as likely to get into trouble as they are in those things. So this is unfortunately the way it can be. But if you have a friend who is the kind of friend, is in the last sentence of this paragraph, who tells you what you need to hear more than what you want to hear, well, then you've got someone who's going to help you. And we need to be those kinds of friends. So we need to be those kinds of friends to one another. And that requires two things. It requires, number one, wisdom on our part. So we, in order to be a good friend in this regard, we have to apply ourselves to learning God's Word and to applying God's Word so that we will have sage advice to give to someone else in any particular circumstance. Secondly, we have to have a proper motivation, which can be summed up in the imperative of love that we're given in Scripture to look out for the best interest of the other. And if you tell someone what they need to hear that they might make those right decisions, then you're being a good friend. If you tell them what they want to hear, or your advice is based out of selfish motivation or a lack of wisdom, then that can be destructive. But when we say two heads are better than one, it depends upon the heads. And that's what we kind of have to keep in mind. It's not always the case. It should be the case. But the demonstration of this, I think, is that's a very applicable among God's people is with regard to the instructions given the appointment of elders in the church. And I've talked with individuals who have thought this to be merely happenstance, that there's nothing significant about it, that every time you find in Scripture elders being appointed or elders serving, it's always a multiplicity. There's always more than one man. And that actually is just entirely different from Protestant denominationalism today, which has a singular pastor. Now, they may have elders, they may have bishops, but they have a pastor. And typically, the pastor is the one who is the driving force in the direction that a church will go and makes the final decisions on things. And that's a single individual. And sometimes a single individual who is lacking in age and lacking in maturity. And it's kind of an interesting thing to see that the model that the religious world has chosen in general is so different from the model that God has given to God's people, which you have more than one man, two heads are better than one, who are wise and discerning, and through that maturity and experience and ability, make decisions that are best for God's people. And that's just an example of what we're talking about. It would be troublesome to have a single individual, no matter his age, no matter his wisdom or experience, to have a single individual unilaterally making decisions for God's people in any organization, any church. So I think there's wisdom in God's design, and that was not merely happenstance, but intentional, to appoint elders in every church that is to be multiple men. Okay, so that's just a little bit of an addition, an aside. Anybody want to add anything to what we've looked at there in that statement of fact that two are better than one? All right, second thing, why are two better than one? Now, we've already talked about that a little bit, got a little ahead, but there are a couple of things that he mentions here that we may not have touched upon. First one is with regard to labor. You'll notice the second part of verse 9 there in chapter 4. They have good reward for their labor. So there is a mutual return when they work together. And there is truth in that. I mean, there are certain things that cannot be done by yourself. And I was doing a little bit of renovation in my garage, and there were a number of times when I had to have help. There's just no way, because of the size of the board that I'm wanting to nail to the wall, or because of the light that I'm trying to screw up into the ceiling to where it's too long for one person. It's always beneficial to have help in that regard.
Moral support too.
And moral support, yeah. You get frustrated if you're having struggle doing things on your own, but. And then the return. You know, not only the one who is willing to share the load, but the sense of accomplishment that is shared, and even if it were something to be done for like building a business and such, the success is something that is more, it's sweeter if an individual has one to share it with. And so there is that. And so just kind of the concept of companionship here in various areas. In this particular area, talking about labor. In verse 10 of the text, talking about an individual who is weak or in some travail, and how it's so good to have someone there to help you when you have fallen, when you have failed in some way. Verse 10, it says, if one falls, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. So it's a practical thing. And it's taken literally in that sense. It makes sense. If you've fallen down, I've fallen and I can't get up. That's what they have, the necklaces for people who are alone at home and they can't get up on their own. There was a few months ago that Hope fell in her front yard. She has a necklace. She wasn't wearing it. And she basically laid in her yard until someone noticed her and was able to help her up, which was quite a while. And so these kinds of things can be true. But it's not only that. The application can be made with regard to any failure on our part, not just physically falling, and to have someone. And I like what he said in the second sentence there. It is wonderful to have a friend who lends a compassionate hand. It's not only help, but compassion being shown. Because it is something that... and just to think about that, and I come across it quite a bit, where individuals, you know, if you are in a situation where you, because of some vulnerability that you have, you falter, it can be an embarrassing thing. And as a result of that, it is possible. Let's say maybe an elderly person and their child is helpful but resentful. Then that can cause a lot of harm emotionally, spiritually. It also is something that is very unpleasant. But with compassion is shown, is something that is very much beneficial. So we want to be able to help one another, but we also need to show compassion when that help is being given. Now the last sentence here is likewise good. He's using again the application with regard to brethren. There is, in the individual, probably this way in every congregation, that if they are in need of help, just about everybody in the congregation is going to help them. And there's a reason for that. Number one, they're always present, and they're always helping others. So they're present in the congregation, they're a part of the group, they have shown their love and expressed their love to others in so many occasions where they've touched the lives of so many people, that when it comes their time, need of help, they don't have to ask. They're going to receive that help from others because of how they have been helpful. So to have a friend, it's important to be a friend. There are others who may say, you know, why am I being left out, or why am I, why have someone not noticed me when I have a need? And it may very well be because you have been absent. You've not been, it's difficult to be in the mind. Now, we need to overcome that. Don't misunderstand. As brethren, even someone in our number, let's say, who's not being as faithful as they should be, or is not helped others whenever there is that need, we need to still be mindful. But it's more difficult for us to have them in our minds when they have not been integral to our lives. And if you want help at any time, you want to be benefited by brethren, then the best thing you can do is to be integral to their lives and be helpful to them. And you will not have want in that regard. There will always be individuals who will help you. So I think there is some good to be said there. And we're looking at it from different points of view. Like I said, this is from the point of view of me wanting friends. In order to want to, if I want friends, in order to have friends, I need to be a friend to others. And I think that's a good lesson for us to learn.
And I've run across several times where, you know, you're trying to help someone. They say, oh, no, you know, we're doing okay. You know, they're not willing to accept, you know, the things that we need to be doing for them. So, and, you know, I've done myself in the same situation. You know, they're sick or something, somebody says, you know, can I bring a pot of soup or something? You know, oh, no, we're doing fine. You know, instead of letting them do it.
Yeah, there you go. You don't want to be in a position. That's, right. I think really that's less, it's possibly somewhat just a human inclination. I think it's an American inclination more than anything else. I think it's the kind of the way we're raised as a society, which places a great deal of value in self-sufficiency and the work ethic, to where you don't want, I'm not going to take any charity from people. I'm not going to be a charity case, that there's some shame in that.
But I finally told that person, I said, you know, you're preventing me from doing what I should be doing.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the way we ought to look at it as Christians. Sometimes it's hard for us. And some of the most spiritually minded and most giving of individuals have struggled with that. And there are several that I know that they are that I can think of in my own experience, to where they would, at the drop of the hat, they're always doing for others, but they're very, very unwilling to let you do for them. But I think that's the proper attitude to have. And I've mentioned this before. It's necessary, because of the work that I do as a preacher, especially in meeting work, for me to be accepting of others' hospitality and benevolent actions. And it grates against me a little bit, just like it does anyone else, especially since I really don't need it. But having people pay for my meals or insisting on certain gifts and those kinds of things. And I've learned that the best thing to do is just to give a gracious thank you to them for that, instead of objecting. And because of that very reason, what the Apostle Paul said in the Philippian letter is that his joy in the support that they gave him was less because they felt his need, because he had learned in whatever state he was to be content. But it was more because of the value that was accrued to them, the spiritual benefits that were theirs because of their grace that they extended to him. So that's the attitude that we ought to have. We ought to know that it is something that is expected of us to help others, and that God rewards us if we offer up that help. But be aware, if we are on the receiving end, that these individuals are doing God's will and his work, and that they are blessed even to a greater extent than we by giving to us and helping us. We're mindful in that. We may still have to grit our teeth a little bit, but we can say thank you and appreciate it and take advantage of the generosity that others show us. That's, again, benevolent area, hospitality, those kinds of things. But there is that emotional aspect, too, of being there for individuals that is very helpful. All right. Anybody else about that particular point? That gets us to the third point, which is similar. There's not a whole lot of difference between weakness and vulnerability, but you'll notice in verse 11, it says, how can one be warm alone? So, and again, it's a principle. It says goes beyond bedtime warmth, marriage relationship. He's pointing out, or at least by application, that the world can be a cold and scary place where we are exposed, and there is help whenever you have brethren or others, friends, who are willing to be with you in those situations. So he gives some examples that are pretty, I think, legitimate. First, down a new job. Perhaps you've been in a situation where you're in a new job and doing the best that you can, and a mistake is made, or you're not comfortable with things, and someone who's been there comes to you and gives you some help. And I haven't had a real job in a long, long time, I guess, in the sense of a working secular employment. But there was a time when I was working in Odessa, having to work a secular job because we didn't have enough support in the congregation for me to preach full time. And this job, it was like my first day on the job, and I was told to clean out and gave some general instructions to clean out this storeroom. And as a result of that, I ended up throwing away some things that were of value. But I was following the instructions. But if I'd had any experience at all, I would have known either I don't think this is included or go to ask, and I didn't. And my boss, the guy that was, he kind of took a deep breath, and he said, that was my fault, not yours, and was very gracious to me. And because I thought I was going to get fired at first because of that, just one day on and I'd been gone. But instead, he kind of took the hit for me. And I appreciated that very much because I was in a vulnerable situation. I didn't have much say in that regard. But families that are someone's in surgery. There are a number of times, and it's usually men who tell me this. They say, okay, what time is your surgery? Oh, well, it's 8 o'clock in the morning, but you don't need to come. And I tell them, I'm not coming for you. I'm coming for your wife. I'm not going to be there for you. I'm going to be there for her. Because there is that vulnerability, again, concern. And it may simply be just visiting to pass the time is a relief and a help in those situations. But that's certainly a vulnerable time where a friend is helpful. So those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. It is basically the warmth that a friend can show when we're in times of vulnerability.
That reminded me of a time when I think Daddy was having one of his maybe back surgery, I don't know. And Joe and PA had come up with us. And of course, when my sisters and I are together, we handle our grief and our stress with just being silly. And they got so angry at us, and PA just looked at me like, you better straighten up. You're in this waiting room.
That's funny.
But they stayed the course. They were there for hours.
Put up with you.
But I got the look. And I was a woman, a grown woman.
Yeah, PA can get that look.
Joe chuckled a little bit.
But you learned a lesson.
I don't know if I did
it. I think she just laughed it off.
All right, and the last one is very much a physical thing, and that is mutual protection when we are attacked. The one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. That's something that practically we understand. So often on college campuses, they're talking about the vulnerability of young women on college campuses and the typical instructions given to them when they get there. Never go by yourself alone, especially after dark. Always have someone with you because there is a lot of support and help. It's not a guarantee by any means, but it's something that can help. And the interesting application, as indicated in Mark 6 and Luke 10, is how Jesus sent out the disciples when he sent them out to preach, because he sent them out two by two. And Luke 10, which is the second of those passages, he said as he sent them out two by two that I send you as sheep among the wolves. The recognition that they were vulnerable and that there was a danger that was there. And so there is protection physically with regard to a friendship. And well, we don't have to enlarge upon that. It's troublesome these days to note that because there is so much vulnerability, so much evil and violence that is in the world today, that when you're by yourself, you are vulnerable. So be vigilant, but it's best if you have someone with you too.
Makes me think of Peter, though, who cut off. What's his name? His ear.
Yeah.
That's exactly.
And
go.
Is that your? No.
Servant's ear.
Oh, never mind.
The guards, I forget his name.
The way you were talking about.
Yeah, the sword in the garden. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting thing because with the shootings, church shootings recently, I'm on a preacher's forum and on Facebook where someone raised the question, "What are you?" Is anyone doing anything with regard to self-defense in the churches? And if so, what is it? And it devolved very quickly into a theological discussion. And I say devolved because that wasn't the intent of the post. It was just, what are you doing? And preachers began discussing whether or not self-defense is appropriate in those situations. This is an indication of culture. From what I understand of the participants in that, the two positions that were taken very much was geographical. Northern preachers were much more pacifistic in regard to that and saying, basically, we're not doing anything because you shouldn't, because Christians can't. Whereas others were justifying it, and they were typically from the South. So maybe there's some vestiges of the Civil War and conflicts in the past that remain as far as those things. And I think it's right and proper to make a distinction between self-defense and suffering for the cause of Christ, and a distinction be made there. But having said that, this is a reality of our society today. They talk about soft targets. That's the typical thing. And the reason why churches are focused on and have been recently with the last couple of mass shootings is because they're soft targets. It is understood in some states it's against the law to have guns in church. In some it's not. But the perception of the individual who's going to do the attack is this would be a good place and good time to go off and attack because you're not going to have an armed response ready. And so the idea of a soft target is there, and when a person is by himself, he is a soft target. He just is. When I was talking with my son about self-protection, and we were discussing whether or not to get a concealed carry license for having a gun, he told me, he said, "Dad, you know, you can just run away." I said, "Well, that's good for you." I said, "But if I tried to run away as I'm running, they're going to be running circles around me as I'm going down the line making fun of me trying to run away from them because I just don't have the speed to do that anymore. So it's not going to work for me to run away. They're faster than me." But, you know, it's a soft target. That's just the idea. And so it's not a guarantee by any means, especially in our evil, to have a companion, but that's something that's beneficial. And protection afforded in numbers. So that's an ideal. But he also makes an application, said, when someone is shooting at you, having reference not to physical ammo, but suspicious of your motives, lying about you to gain an advantage, in other words, attacking you, or attacking your person, attacking your character, your motives and such, to have someone who would pull along and say, "I believe in you," or that this is not legitimate, "I know this person, and what you're saying is not true," is something that can be helpful and beneficial. So their applications can be made, I think, both spiritual and physical with regard to all of these things. And our important consideration is the spiritual rather than the physical. All right, so anything about point number two? Anyone wants to add to what we've discussed? There are these examples that are given, and we won't spend a lot of time on them, but they do personify that, the prophetic partnership of Elijah and Elisha. The relationship that Ruth and Naomi had as mother-in-law to daughter-in-law, David and Jonathan's friendship, Paul and Timothy, where you had the mentor and mentee, Paul and Luke, the companion in his travels, and Barnabas and John Mark and their traveling together in missionary work. These are all examples of individuals who complemented and helped one another in the work and mission that they were to accomplish for the Lord. So those are good examples. And well worth the time to examine. Maybe that's a be a series of six lessons right there for a sermon series that would be probably pretty beneficial.
Aquila and Priscilla.
Oh yeah, I mean those are just a few lists. Yeah. I mean, in fact, it's kind of interesting because it's Paul and Luke and Barnabas, John Mark. What about Paul and Barnabas?
Right.
You know, because that would be, they had their disagreement and went their separate ways in their journeys, but when they were together, they were pretty powerful as a pair. So there are a lot of other examples that we can give as well. Okay, so with that in mind, there are some final thoughts that he gives beginning in verse 13 going down through verse 16. Who would like to read that? Tracy, please.
There we go. Oh, I can see.
4:13-16.
13. A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. For he has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. There is no end to all the people, to all who were before them. And even the ones who will come later will not be happy with him. For this, too, is vanity and striving after the wind.
Okay, so it's not abundantly evident, but I think that the proper explanation of this text is that there are three people under consideration in this text. There is the poor and wise youth who replaces the old and foolish king. And then there is another youth that is stated in verse 15 who replaces the poor and wise youth as king. And it is the second one who stands in the place of the first poor and wise youth with whom those individuals who come after would not rejoice in. Okay? So that seems to be the construct of this particular section, which is important because he makes some applications utilizing that understanding of the text. And I think that's true. Otherwise, you have the poor and wise youth who is indicated as being a good king, and yet in verse 16, perhaps he wasn't a good king, and that really doesn't make much sense. So looking at this, the first individual under consideration in verse 13 is the old and foolish king. So he is an individual who has reached the point to where he has been the giver of orders for so long that he is not willing to listen to anyone or take any instruction from any other individual. That's foolishness. Anytime an individual believes that he already knows everything is a fool. He's a fool if he believes that. And so here is an indication, and I think the application we can make is for an individual who has a closed mind. I remember that there have been there are some things that I have said from the pulpit that have been questioned in this regard. So maybe some clarification would be helpful. Because it can be misconstrued. There was an older preacher that was preaching. It was actually in a congregation in Odessa, Texas. And he was in conflict with some of the younger people in the congregation. And that's what they were accusing of him, was already having his mind made up. And his answer was, I only preach things that I have settled in my mind. Well, that's a valid point. You don't want to proclaim something that you're not sure about. And he was much older than they were. He was much wiser than they were. He had a better understanding and grasp of Scripture than that. They had some innovation they wanted to bring into play. And he said, no, that's not right. Well, you just have a closed mind. And he said, I had a settled conviction, which to them was it, yeah, that's what I said, you had a closed mind. And so we need to recognize there's a difference between having a closed mind and a settled conviction. There are certain things we can know to be true, and we need to trust in that. One of the problems that I have is with young preachers, and I see this again in these forums and such, that will throw out new things that And it's interesting, they throw them out as novel new ideas when in fact they've been debated for centuries and the truth has been established and those arguments have been refuted. But they don't know that because they haven't delved deeply enough, and so they study and they see something, think, ah, and it's something that is different than what they have heard before, and it seems right to them. And I've told the young men that I've come across in preaching, including my son, is that the first time that you open the book and you come up with some idea that you've never heard preached before, he said, that ought to scare you to death. You ought to be afraid that this might be error, that there's something wrong. So the first thing you need to do is go to men that you trust and say, I'm reading this. This seems to be right to me. Is it? And if not, why not? And I've told them, I've done that a number of times in my preaching. And almost invariably, I was shown why it's not true. You know, in other words, there was something that was missing in my logic. But there are individuals who will instead, they'll take that, they'll proclaim it, preach it because they think this is something new. And once you have proclaimed it and preached it, if criticism comes, now you are in a position where you feel the need to defend it. And you can get settled in your position and it'd be an error. When is if you're going as a supplicant and saying to another person who has more knowledge than me, show me where I'm wrong, if I'm wrong, then you're more open-minded. And so a settled conviction is not the same thing as a closed mind. Having said that, there is a real danger as we grow older. And this perhaps is less a situation with regard to doctrinal things, although it can certainly be applicable in that, to where we have a way of doing things or a view with regard to advice as to what is best that hasn't kept up with the changing of times and is perhaps now either irrelevant or not as effective as other things. But it's the way we did it. And maybe the way our parents did it or our grandparents did it, and this is the best way. And that kind of a closed-mindedness is something that can really be destructive. One of the things that I keep up with is technology, and there's some technology podcasts that I listen to. And one of them in particular is kind of deals with politics and such too. And they're always complaining about the fact that the Congress and the President and all them, that they have absolutely no clue with regard to technology, and yet they're the ones that are setting laws and making laws about these new innovations and what can and what can't happen. And most of the time, what they're doing is completely missing the point. In other words, they're so out of touch with the new reality of the way things work that the laws that they're setting are hamstringing development and innovation or not solving the problems that they're intended to solve. And so what happens when you get these technologists, they go up there and they talk to them about it, and because it's not the way it's always been done. You know, this worked when we were, you know, had steam engines and Detroit was big and all this kind of stuff, and it'll work now, and it doesn't anymore. And it's because they can't gain new ideas. And there's some truth to that with regard to churches as well. With regard to, let's say, the proclamation of the gospel. The gospel is the same, has to be. The techniques are different. You know, when we first started with PowerPoint, people got upset. Now social media is something that can be utilized in the proclamation of truth. And there are individuals who will say, no, that's not right. We shouldn't do that. When in fact, much benefit can come from it if it's utilized correctly. And the point is that we need to be open-minded, never compromise truth, but open-minded as to new ideas. Of course, that's spiritually, and I think that the same thing can be said. Parents need to be open-minded with regard to the realities of the new age that we're in, so that they make decisions that may not be the same decisions that their parents before them made. You know, I was talking to Kaylee Sawyer through a fit in the grocery store, and Sawyer's got a mind of her own. So she threw a fit in the grocery store, and I think Kaylee spat at her with her hand, and you know, she said, I'm going to have to get a wooden spoon and put it in my purse. Well, I think that's what her mama did on occasion, had a wooden spoon put in her purse, and because it's a little bit more effective. Just a pop on the backside with a wooden spoon is a little different. I told her, I said, get the wooden spoon, but don't use it in public. You don't want to use it in public. And it's not a matter of the importance of disciplining them when they're acting up. I understand and recognize that, but you also don't want your child taken away from you. And in the culture that we're in today, probably not best to do that, because someone is going to see it and someone's going to call Child Protective Services. When all you've done is discipline your child, you're going to be in trouble with the law because of it. So it's a reality of our day, and we need to be aware of those things. So,
a woman beats that child that's been, you saw her skin nose.
Yeah, she has been beat up a little bit recently, hasn't she?
Oh, bless your heart.
Yeah. Most of those things happen when Kid or Katie wasn't around. So, yeah, the babysitter is where that happened. Skin nose at least. Anyway, so that kind of idea, the applications are so broad. It's really a sad situation when you've reached the point where you're not willing to hear new ideas and to learn new things. Our mind should always be open to that. But as we grow older, they tend to be said, and that's foolishness. That's what he puts. So you can put yourself in that picture. It says, better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish older person. You don't have, it had to be the king. He is the king. That's why he's making application to himself. But I think we can do the same.
We're never too old to learn.
That's right.
I had a friend that told me that she had settled her belief on baptism 30 years ago, that don't bother talking to her about it. That she decided it wasn't essential to salvation 30 years ago. She was not open to conversation. I almost opened the door and threw her out, but I didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
And the car was going.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, I think in situations like that, about the only response you can have, which may not have any be helpful at all, but just say, okay, you are convinced. What convinced you? Mm-hmm. Then you'll convince me then. Uh-huh. If you're convinced,
that was exactly what
then
I said.
Convince me. Yeah, mm-hmm. And explain to me why this passage doesn't teach the necessity of that, and this passage doesn't teach, and this passage doesn't. Yeah. And but yeah, chances are they wouldn't be willing to talk to you anyway. Yeah.
But I did learn to make sure that I didn't have that same mindset. Well, I decided that 30 years ago.
Yeah. And that's that.
Not about baptism.
That's that last thing about the point is, don't confuse me with the facts. My mind is already made up.
Yeah.
And that's when I was talking about that old preacher, I've got a settled conviction on this matter. What that means is he studied it, and so it's not that I'm not willing to study with someone and to share with them why this is right and what the other is wrong. And if you come up with something new I haven't heard before, consider it what I haven't heard. But again, that's typically not what's under consideration with regard to the innovation, the person who's trying to bring in the innovation. There are two sides to the coin. I can say that I have a settled conviction. I have, and it has been more than 30 years ago, where I determined that I had to be baptized in order to be saved, and that baptism was necessary for salvation. But I'm willing to study with anyone about that and listen to their arguments and examine their arguments to determine whether, they are in accord with Scripture or not. And that's the difference in the mindset.
Well, and we're supposed to have an answer for our beliefs. So to say, for anybody, whether it's a Christian or like her friend, that's just wrong, I think.
Yeah, individuals are not
their heart's not where it should.
People don't want to talk religion today. We're just in that period of time where it's very seldom considered acceptable. I mentioned this just recently, the event that I put up on one social media site, objections were raised for our lectureship that... there are two things that happened. One guy, he's antagonistic toward churches in general, and if I've got to see this, then I'm going to object to it. That was his point. And if someone is being that way, you're supposed to be able to report them, and the moderators will either delete the text or they'll deal with the person if it's legitimate. Well, nothing was done. So apparently, whoever it was thought it didn't raise itself to the point where he hijacked my post and was acting inappropriately. But the other one was one of the moderators, and basically said, I appreciate you posting this. This is the type of thing we want posted, but please don't talk about personal convictions and differences on this site. Social media, that's what you're supposed to do, But what I was doing is I was answering questions that others had asked about us and about our beliefs and what we... And that was just, don't do that. But he wasn't admonishing me for answering it. He was admonishing people for asking me. don't ask religious questions. In other words, as a moderator, don't ask religious questions. If you wanted to answer a religious question, then message them personally, privately.
Was this on the neighborhood thing?
Yeah, next door. So it's not up on the site. And also, what's so objectionable about an exchange of religious ideas on a website?
Exchange everything else.
Yeah, everything else is, yeah. They talk about a lot of different things. Politics is a big thing that's done on there, but not religion. And I thought that was a peculiar thing. But the view of society is that religion is personal. And you have a right to have your beliefs, but you do not have the right to share those beliefs with others. And that's an unfortunate thing, because we are given the command to share our personal beliefs, our religious beliefs, with other people. And, I don't know how many times I've been called down for proselytizing. You know, it's all right for you to think the way you do, but how dare you say this to someone else? You don't have that right. Well, God gives me the right.
Don't read it. Go on.
That's why you have insurance. Unfortunately.
Yeah, that's one of them. Okay, all right, that's all with regard to that section. Then we've got the final thought. Oh, wait a second, we are in the final thoughts, aren't we? So, second point, verse 14, under Solomon's final thoughts. It notes poetically that some of the best rulers often come from humble beginnings. You know, talking about the poor and wise youth. What about in the United States of America? Who best personifies that?
Today or
no, in history?
Abraham Gates.
That's who I added my Abraham Lincoln. Yeah.
I think Bill Gates and college.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. Yeah, he actually dropped out of college to become a billionaire.
Yeah, but he was made it to college, so he had some kind of means.
But Abraham Lincoln taught himself to read, didn't have an education, formal education at all, became a lawyer, and considered one of the better presidents in the United States. And it was partly because of his upbringing. I mean, I think that has a big part of it. And then you've got what's typical in our society today, and it I think is as much a problem with the people as it is with the system as it is with the individuals. But the flash in the pan, promise them everything, politician that's mentioned here in verse 15, the one who comes after. And that's what we have today. But the interesting thing about that is it kind of correlates with what Paul warned when he said that there would be individuals who would no longer be willing to heed the truth, but would heap up to themselves teachers having itching ears. They would not endure sound doctrine. So that kind of individual, he looks for someone who will tell him what he wants to hear. And that's what we have as a society in politics today, is a bunch of people who they want to be given promises. But what happens is, say in the major... we've got a broken system, so you get politicians that are elected promising all these changes, and they're ineffectual when they get in office. They aren't able to give you what they promised that they'd give you. And as a result of that, people get upset with them. And public applause, temporary, public opinion turns quickly, and the public would not be happy with that individual. So this is kind of what happens with regard to that.
That's in the turning from one to another. I mean, people look to preachers.
Used to be all preachers pretty much were self-made, but not as much anymore. And that can be kind of an unfortunate thing. It's not necessarily there's anything wrong with higher education and classes, Bible classes and such, to teach individuals. It's that if a hurtful or even unscriptural influence is found in the instruction that is being given to a large group of men, that those young men can be molded in a direction that is not in accord with Scripture. And I think there's some validity in saying if you're a self-made person, you get in and you dig it out for yourself, which is possible. I mean, it's not like rocket science. You don't have to have some real accomplished individual. That's one of the things I tell you just a little bit off the subject, but a little rant because of personal peeve of mine. It really bothers me to a certain extent that so many efforts seem to be made of American preachers going into foreign lands and training preachers. And I recognize that there is benefit to it. In fact, you know, I had a part to play in one trip. But the idea that you've got to go over there year after year after year, and you have individuals who are coming and coming, because I never got that. You know, and I don't think that it was necessary. And for them to feel that they need this rather than open up the Bibles and study for themselves. You know, we're going to give you the knowledge as to how to study. You know, teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. We're going to teach you how to study, what to look out for, some tools to use, the basic principles laid down. Go dig it out for yourself. And there's benefit to that. And I think sometimes we are fostering in our desire to be missionary in our work and sharing the gospel in other lands, that we are in effect fostering in them a dependence upon us. And I think every effort that we go over there to try to share the message is to make them self-sustaining. I think that's what Paul did. He went and preached in different places. He established the congregation so that when he was with them or when he was not with them, they would do what was right. And that's important.
Well, and today too, we have the internet. You can.
Well, yeah, but that, but again, even then, you know, every man who preaches needs to be able to study for himself and to derive. I mean, every Christian needs to have that ability, because ultimately your convictions, what you believe is what you're going to be judged by, what you believe and do. And you can't say, well, someone taught me wrong in the day of judgment and be excused because of it. So we have to have that ability ourselves.
You think maybe one reason is the results are more over there? Because
yeah, I do. I don't want to be overly critical in that regard. It's just that, I mean, I just the work that I was a part of in India, it just seems to me that it should have developed, some of the individuals should have developed more. And instead of them appealing so much, we need you again, instead of saying, okay, we got it now. You know, there should be more of that. But I think that the appeal for American preachers going over there is that it is a very rewarding work for those who have that mind. Because you have people who are really open-minded and desiring truth and just eat it up. You know, it's one thing to come and to preach to a group and they're looking at their watches and their eyes are rolling and they're checking out, and you go over there and preach for 2 hours and they're just staring with rapt attention. And you've gone for 2 hours, you take a break, go back for 2 more hours, and you get 5 baptisms, and you know, those kinds of things happen. That's, well, that helps the ego of American preachers. It's a very rewarding work. And a lot of people, I don't enjoy going overseas, but a lot of men do for that very reason, because it is so rewarding. You feel like you're making a difference over there. And that's a pleasant thing. But I'm not saying that it's not, and it's not appropriate, because it certainly is. But I'm just saying that I don't like the... What seems to me sometimes is to be a dependence upon, because it's an American brand of Christianity. I mean, we cannot divorce ourselves from our culture, and that doesn't always work in other places. And we have to understand that they do things differently over there culturally, and still doing the same thing scripturally. But when we try to bring in, I mean, one of the big things that happened over in India is that institutional churches started going over there, and they established a sponsoring church arrangement over there immediately. And when we went over to India the first time, that's what we had to deal with. We didn't get to preach to the Hindus. We didn't get to do much other than trying to get some preachers to come out of that institutional error. And we were successful in that, and it has grown. But to this day, the work that, well, up until 2 years ago, the work that Mark Smith did, Joe Price did, Bobby Holmes, myself, Jeff Smith, and several others that went over there, what was being done was dealing with the institutional error. You'd think going over to India with this gigantic population that we would make more inroads. But what we were doing is getting congregations that were engaged in sponsoring church arrangement, those kinds of things, out of that. That's what was being done. And if that hadn't been exported from America in the first place, that problem wouldn't have been there. But it was. So it's a real danger. All right, well, that's my little rant. Okay, so... But there is that problem with regard to the false teacher, as well as the promise everything politician. And his final thought there in number two is that, giving the example of Rehoboam. So following the death of Solomon, the people believed King Rehoboam was the answer, as they gathered in Shechem to make him king. But it did not take long for him to make foolish decisions, and the people had become disillusioned with him. And And so his point here is that he could have learned from his father and not made the same mistakes. In fact, you remember that's exactly what the wise men counseled Rehoboam. Said, you know, your father taxed us severely, and you need to loosen the burden. And if he would have learned that that was a mistake to oppress the people in that way. I mean, King himself said that about the oppression that was existing. And he was a part of that problem. If Rehoboam would have loosened the then he would have kept the people, but he didn't. So he did not learn from history, and that was that's again a religious application. One of the things we did in our lectureship, the purpose of it, was to look at the mistakes brethren made in the past when they disregarded authority, they changed the New Testament pattern, they began to teach error in the divisions that it was caused, so that we don't make the same mistakes today. And Brad was talking to the men last night in the men's meeting and talked about the benefits of such studies, indicating that, you know, it may not be the same error, but if we're mindful of the dangers of innovations and we hear some new thing, we're not going to be as accepting of it on the surface. We're going to have to study to determine whether it's legitimate or not before we go off, as has been done. People today, they're clamoring in institutional church for instrumental music. It's there. And there are a lot of institutional churches that are doing it now, more and more every day, in fact. And the same other kinds of things, inclusion of women in leadership roles in the church, and things that you would think, well, who would ever do that? But well, you know, the disciples of Christ, that denomination that came out of the Restoration Movement, they are just full blown involved in those kinds of errors, and it's going to happen again. The institutional church, it will be institutional, and it may divide off. You may have the conservative institutional churches and then the very liberal conservative church, and they already don't have fellowship with one another. The Birdville Church of Christ 20 years ago withdrew, as if a church could withdraw fellowship from another church, but that's what they did. That's the institutional concept. They withdrew fellowship from the North Richland Hills Church of Christ. Birdville Church did. They were an institutional church themselves, but those crazy liberals over there at North Richland Hills, way too far. And so they withdrew fellowship from them as a church. So it's kind of a division. How far will you go? But the problem is that continues if we don't learn from history.
They call themselves conservatives.
Yes. Well, actually, I don't know. Do they call themselves that?
I don't know about Birdville, but I know Legacy Church does.
They actually refer to them in that way.
Yeah.
Because I thought that was a... I know that was a...
Well, conservative and liberals.
Well, that was a term that I thought Mark Dean coined. I mean, not Mark Dean. Mark Dean. Wayne Goforth coined. And he's used that a lot. But of course, he came out of institution. Wayne Goforth did before.
I had a friend that... Your family that goes there. She said, "No, Tracy, we're conservatives."
Oh, that's interesting.
And I had that same reaction. I said, "That's what you call yourself?"
that make a lot of sense. Conservative liberals, that's kind of an oxymoron. All right, that's all we have time for. We'll pick up with letter B there and next time and get into the digging deeper questions. So go ahead and get into chapter 5 and be prepared for that. And what we'll do is, today is the 15th, the 22nd, 29th, 11:29 is when we'll start. There's a letter B at the bottom of page 19. All right, appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.